As an entrepreneur, you need to be leveraging tools and software to run your business as smoothly and efficiently as possible. That is why I'm delighted to partner with Sage for this season of the pod. Sage is the global market leader for technology that helps small and medium businesses perform at their best. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description.
I mean, we signed up one major retailer after another. Between 2009 and 2012, when we started Paris and Hotel, actually, we actually doubled the turnover of the business that time from probably 25 million a year to 50 million a year.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, I'm chatting to John Toohey, the founder of Oopod. That is a fun business name to say in your mouth. What a cool name. He is the former founder of Nightline and Parson Motel, which we'll all know very well. And he takes me through his whole story of founding Nightline back in 1992 with just £10,000, for building both businesses up to be turning over 65 million euro in 2017 when he sold the business. He's back with a brand new venture, and I hear all about it. This is my chat with John Toohey, the founder of Oopod. John, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here.
And as we discussed, pod has many, many meanings in the business world.
Yes, it does. And our new venture, Oopod, the letters stand for out of home and then proof of delivery, which are both terms that are widely used in the parcel delivery business. So we put them together and just used the first letters of the words that we thought it was a catchy brand name, and more importantly, we were able to register the .com for $10 as opposed to paying $500,000 for a six-letter .com, which is quite important, you know?
Definitely is when you're starting out. Oopod, I like the name. You're going to have some quirky ads coming our way with that one, I think.
Yeah, look, we as you know, my previous foray into the parcel locker business was Parson Hotel, which was hugely successful. And Parson Hotel would be recognized as the most successful implementation of a parcel locker network anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. In China, Parson Hotel was the only standalone profitable parcel locker network anywhere in the world. So it got a lot of attention at the time.
Wow. But,
The same consultants and the same branding agency that developed the Parson Hotel brand for us also did Oopod. So the guys really, I think they did a great job yet again.
So we'll start back at the start, I guess. Nightline, yeah, and Parson Hotel. What came first?
So Nightline came first. That was a company that I co-founded with Dave Field. We were both working with FedEx, the multinational parcel delivery business, in the early 90s. And we left FedEx and started Nightline. And it was a real entrepreneurial success story, because we started Nightline basically from the spare bedroom of my home at the time. It was just me and Dave and two little vans and one mobile phone between us, because we couldn't afford two. And we started Nightline on the 2nd of May, 1992. And we sold it on the 2nd of May, 2017, to UPS. So it was exactly 25 years to the day. And it started off with just the two of us. And when the day we sold it, we had about 1,200 people employed, and just a huge business. It was well beyond its entrepreneurial phase. It was really a large business at that stage. So UPS came along and bought it in 2017. And myself and Dave left the business as part of the deal with UPS. So then I took a couple of years out, took some time out, learned a few things, did a few courses, tried to learn to play the guitar, something I promised myself I'd been doing for years. I had a guitar collection, but couldn't play any of them. So I tried to play that. So satisfied that itch, and now I know I definitely can't play the guitar.
The 2 years didn't do it, no.
No. the guitar teacher we got to the point, because I love music. I love all sorts of music, and I'd go to a lot of concerts and so on. My guitar teacher eventually used to just come to the house and we'd talk about music for half an hour, maybe try and play a few chords. So, but look, it's a great gift to have. And my son, who's in transition year now, he's 16, is a great musician and can play guitar and a number of other instruments. So it's great that he has that, because I wish I could.
Maybe it skips a generation. Maybe it's like one of those things, you know.
I wouldn't feel too bad about it. I've been drumming it into him since he could walk. That you listen, you know. I've been playing any opportunity I got, I'd be playing music, and especially in the car and so on. So hopefully that's something I've left them with. And my daughter as well is very musical. So hopefully that's something I've instilled in them anyway.
They've picked it up. What was, I'm going to jump in the middle and then I'm going to jump way back. What was it like the day after you sold the business?
Let me see. Okay. So the way that kind of works out is, I probably should answer the rest of your question there first, right? So we started Nightline in 1992 and started out building that up, that parcel delivery business that a lot of people would be familiar with, the green and white vans. And then in 2012, when the whole e-commerce and online delivery thing started taking off, we started Parcel Motel. So Parcel Motel was a part of Nightline. And we started out in 2012. So Nightline was in business 20 years, I think, by the time we started Parcel Motel. And Parcel Motel was our first time to get into a sort of a consumer facing business, because Nightline, all of our customers were other businesses. And in Parcel Motel, it was very much a consumer facing business, which was really exciting. And we really got bitten by the bug. And that's why a lot of the ideas that we had for Parcel Motel, but ran out of time before UPS acquired, we're now sort of trying in UPOD. The day after we sold, so that, to answer that question, it's quite interesting, really, because Nightline was a large business. It was turning over 65 million euro the year we sold it. And UPS is also a large business, as everyone knows. It's the biggest parcel delivery business in the world. So because of the size of the two businesses that we're combining, the CCPC, I think it is in Ireland, they're the guys that they monitor markets and consumer protection and so on. It has to go to them for approval. So the merits of the acquisition, to make sure that, you know, there's no monopolies or there's no adverse effect on the market or particularly for consumers, they have to approve it. So it had to go to them for approval, and that takes 6 weeks. So the day after it was announced that we're going to sell the business, that's great. It was, you know, press releases and all that kind of stuff. But then we had to wait 6 weeks for the CCPC to approve the takeover. And so you have that waiting time. And so the day after that approval came through, it was probably a bit more celebratory, I suppose, where we, we were able to, I was going to say let my hair down, but, we were able to celebrate, you know. As Churchill said, we were able to allow ourselves a brief period of celebration. You know?
And were you continuing then to work in the business for a couple of years, or were you gone?
No, when UPS buy a business, UPS is a very structured organization, and they have their own processes and their own ways of doing things. And it's a bit like John's, a bit like if McDonald's bought John's Burgers, you know. So they had a management team ready to come in and manage the business and integrate with UPS. So they didn't really need me around, which was great. So we left, myself and Dave, the co-founder, the day that the acquisition was approved and UPS were ready to move in and take over. Pretty much that day we finished up and left. Yeah.
Like the final day of school. Was it bittersweet or just sweet?
No, it wasn't sweet. It wasn't sweet at all, because look, first of all, we agonized really, and I do mean that, about whether to sell the business or not, because we were at a point where we had started the business with 10,000 old Irish pounds. So about, what is that, 12 or 13,000 euro. And we had actually built that business up purely by reinvestment of profits and from debt. And so by the time we came along to 2017, the company had a mountain of debt, because we took no additional equity in over the time, over the 25 years we were running the business. So when you don't take in equity, it's got to come out somewhere. And you have a, you know, the debt market for us was quite buoyant in the times we were building up the business. There was a lot of banks operating in Ireland at the time, low interest rates, and you know, in the time, especially before the global financial crash in 2008, we had no problems borrowing money, no problems paying it back. So we had good debt repayment capability. So we spent. So when it came to 2017, the business was really still growing, and it needed capitalization really in terms of investments to invest in the facilities and equipment, and you know, upgrade our software and all that kind of stuff. So the choices we had then were to either take in a private equity partner of some sort, or take in equity of some sort, or do a trade sale. So we had a sort of discussions with some private equity people that were in the market at the time. And in the middle of all that, then we were approached by another multinational actually to buy the business. And we brought that to our corporate finance advisors, who was EY. And they said, look, you know, if there's one multinational interest in buying this business, then there might be others as well. Would you like us to run a bit of a process, as they call it? So we ran a process, and ultimately UPS, and through that UPS ended up acquiring the business. So look, we had a lot of people with us a long time. I mean, a lot of our management team, and that was one of the reasons that it was relatively easy for UPS for us to leave, because we left a very capable management team behind, very loyal employees who had served the business very well for long numbers of years. So yeah, it was, you know, in terms of that sort of emotional side of things, it was difficult to leave that behind, and to leave that sort of life behind, if you like, because you know, a lot of these guys were close friends, and they'd been with us for a long time and helped us build the business up from nothing to the largest Irish owned transport and logistics business. So I think yeah, I couldn't say it was easy or sweet. It was mixed, you know. So
but that's some story from 10,000 pounds to 65 million turnover. That's astronomical.
Yeah, there was a little bit of sort of friends and family money invested in it over the years. So myself and Dave actually didn't own 100% of it when we sold. We had 40% each, and then there was 20% held by friends and family. But it wasn't, that investment would have come in when the business was quite small still. It was 25 years of hard slog. But again, the business was hugely indebted at that time, because we had borrowed a lot of money ahead of the GFC, you know, the global financial crash. Mm. We didn't roll over on any of our debt. We held it and continued to pay it. And we, you know, in 2016, Brexit happened. So there was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of money to be spent on various scenarios after Brexit, the Brexit vote, because if you think about it, the Brexit vote didn't actually crystallize until 2021, when the UK actually left the European Union. The vote came in 2016. So there was 4 or 5 years of a lot of uncertainty there, and a lot of businesses would have had to spend a lot of money on potential scenarios that weren't going to happen. So that needed deep pockets to take a business like Nightline through and Parisian Hotel through that period of uncertainty, and then invest in it for the future, the future. So it, you know, it either needed a partner with deep pockets, like a private equity company, or it needed a trade buyer like UPS, who are the biggest in the world. So that's what happened in the end.
Take me right back. How did it all start? The two of you were working in FedEx, and what was the spark? What was the moment for you? Like, you know what?
Well, look, we didn't really have much choice. FedEx at the time were reorganizing their business. I was actually in senior management when I was quite young. I was probably the most senior manager that FedEx had in Ireland at the time, and I was only 20 or 21 at the time.
Wow.
And then, that was 20 when I was appointed that position. And then FedEx reorganized their business in Europe in 1992. And there was a redundancy package available to myself and Dave, and it was quite a generous one. So we took our redundancy and we left, and we started Nightline. And we originally just look, I suppose that decision was probably taken out of necessity. rather than a burning entrepreneurial ambition. And the choices, I suppose, we had at a time where we could have, you know, the economy was in a grim place in Ireland in 1992, believe it or not. And so the choices for us really were to emigrate or, you know, have a go, start a business and see how it went. We had a number of contacts, clients and so on that we had built up from our time at FedEx. So we decided to give it a go. Kept our costs low at the start by working from my house, built up some client contacts. And what we used to do was just basically buy Aer Lingus tickets, or at the time it was an airline operating between Dublin and London called British Midland, which I think was subsequently acquired by British Airways. Mm. We'd essentially just buy tickets on those airlines and send a courier on the flight over to London with the parcels as their baggage.
No way.
And then we'd inject the parcels into various services in London from there. That's how we started it. Yeah, that's what we used to do. Because in those days, what they were called onboard couriers, it was quite a common way to move
really?
Parcels around.
So a person would literally hop on, bring the parcels with them, and then hop off the far side and distribute them.
Yeah, they'd have the parcels would come out on the baggage, on the carousel as their checked luggage. You know, they'd be in sacks, small parcels, right? And that'd be their checked luggage, and they'd go into the red channel in customs and clear it through customs and then do whatever. That's how DHL started out business, actually. So it was all using flights, onboard couriers all over the world.
That is a mad story.
DHL is the three individuals that started the DHL company. But that's how they started. We're basically getting on flights and flying all over the world, bringing parcels with them. And thinking about, so what happened in the Dublin to London route, because it wasn't just us that was doing that. There was a number of courier companies sending couriers to London every day. And on most Aer Lingus flights every day, at least three or four of the Aer Lingus flights every day would have couriers on it. So Aer Lingus and the other airlines kind of cottoned onto this. Because you could have up to six couriers on the flight, right? And so what Aer Lingus did then was Aer Lingus said that they'd provide the courier. So Aer Lingus would have a staff member on their day off.
Okay.
And they'd go as the courier, and they'd act as the courier for everyone, which was great because it was cheaper for us. We didn't have to buy tickets.
Yeah, and smart. Then,
so that's basically how we started in 92, and we just expanded the business in terms of the product offerings we had and the services we're offering and so on. We built up a very loyal client base, some of whom were with us for the whole of the 25 years that we owned the business, which was great, you know.
And were you B2B or were you both?
Back then, it was all B2B. All our customers were businesses. So it was a B2B business, and it was all business customers that we had, and exporting customers, mainly exporting and needing exporting and importing, I suppose, but needing a very fast service. So a lot of the time, even next day with a conventional courier wasn't fast enough. So we were the guys that specialized in getting spare parts in from Birmingham to Dublin in, you know, 4 hours kind of thing. Because you could have, at the time, there was kind of like, you know, in the early 90s in Ireland, there was a lot of multinational manufacturers here at the time. So if a plant was down, in other words, if they had an assembly line broken down or they needed parts, a lot of the time this could be costing thousands per hour. So a next day delivery by a conventional courier wasn't good enough. So they needed something faster. So we were very specialized in that niche. And even the other courier companies, if their clients asked them to get something in hours rather than days, those guys would run that business into us as well. We'd a massive trade business, where the other courier companies and freight forwarders in the trade would use us for specialized work like that, you know.
I get you. And a business like that today seems logical when you have instant communication, WhatsApp, you're kind of constantly connected to everybody. But back then, that must have been a very complex business to set up.
Yeah, look, our raw material back then was basically myself and Dave used to be sitting opposite each other in an office, small office near the airport, and we used to have a phone and a calculator and a notepad in front of us, and our contacts book, which I still have at home. It'll go in the museum one of these days. We had just an actual contacts book, you know, an alpha index book, yeah. And we used to have all our contacts all over the world listed in that. So we had it in the desk between us, and we used to just have a phone, calculator, We didn't. I don't think we even had PCs. We probably had one PC in the office that we used for, doing spreadsheets or accounts or something like that. And then everything that we did, so if somebody phoned us and said, look, we need something done and we need it done fast, we'd say, okay, we need something done in Germany or whatever. We'd look up our book to see who we knew that was near there. We'd get them. These were all sort of corresponding agents, and we'd just built up these contacts over the years. And so then we'd put it all together, get a guy in Germany to pick up the parts, bring them to an airport, either get on the plane with them or send them air freight to us, and then we'd send it here. And then we'd get it here and deliver it to the client or whatever, or the reverse, we might pick it up here and get it out to Germany and get it delivered quickly. So it was something that the raw material really was our contacts around the world and being able to get stuff done quickly. And it was all about the telephone and then all of the instructions. So if we were sending an instruction to an agent in Germany to do something for us, back then it was write out a fax. The fax are true. The fax machine was the fastest method of communication to those days, you know.
It seems like a complex business that is hard to do and hard to scale. How did you go from you and Dave to 65 million turnover?
In that sort of niche business that was very profitable for us, I suppose a very good lifestyle kind of business from that. And as that started to get busier, we just started to hire extra people. And actually my wife is the first, was our first employee back in 1993. So, you know, and then we had, we just started hiring people, as we needed them then after that. But then I suppose by 2000, the economy in Ireland was changing then, because a lot of the companies that had come here to make products like PCs and there was those sort of stats about Ireland in the early mid 90s. I think we were the country where the most PCs were made outside of North America. It was because you had Dell here and you'd get
Dell, we're down in Limerick, yeah, Gateway as well. Yeah, you forget about that actually.
So we actually had a huge manufacturing sector in Ireland, multinational manufacturing sector in Ireland. But towards the late 90s, as the Eastern European, in particular Poland and all these economies opened up, and became more accessible, a lot of manufacturing started to move further east. So it either went to Eastern Europe or went further on, to China or so on. So the manufacturing sectors in Ireland, that whole thing started to dry up a bit. And as that sort of niche sort of requirement, importing and exporting, was starting to sort of stagnate for us a bit as well. So we had to look around for ways to diversify the business into other markets. And that's where we got into the within Ireland domestic market. In other words, moving parcels from Dublin to Cork and so forth. Whereas we hadn't been in that space before. We were purely an import and export business. And when we got into that line of business, we had to expand. So we had to, when we had decided to get into that line of business, a number of the clients we were serving on the international side had asked us if we'd consider getting into the within Ireland distribution business, because there were, the services that were available to them at the time, the standards of service weren't great. So we examined the market and we got into the domestic parcel delivery business. When we say domestic, we mean within Ireland parcel delivery business. So that meant we had to go and open delivery depots, I think five or six delivery depots within, within the same month kind of thing, and get it all tooled up and write all the software to hand to scan the parcels and all this kind of stuff. So that meant borrowing a lot of money, and we did. So we had to scale that up, hire people all over the country, hire drivers, all that kind of stuff. So that was like a whole new startup. We had built a whole new rail track, put a train on it, and then we had to start filling it with passengers. So
what year was that?
A few years down. That was 2001, I think.
Okay.
So, yeah. So nearly 10 years after we started the business initially. So then the business became really big. And then we started to acquire contracts. We specialized in high-value goods moving around Ireland. So we quickly acquired all of the mobile phone distribution business in Ireland, all of the tobacco business in Ireland for the tobacco companies, things like games, consoles, software, anything that was theft sensitive, high value. We were the experts in that, in distributing that type of product. And then we had other general general products as well, that complemented that, that went along there to reduce our unit costs and so on. And then by 2000, that's 2001, and say 2009, then the whole e-commerce thing really started to take off. And we actually stayed well out of the home delivery business. You'd find this ironic now, if somebody gave us a parcel that was going to a private address, in other words, to somebody's home, to a home address, we would surcharge that, you know, because we'd say it's just so expensive to do that, to do a home delivery. We charge a surcharge for it because we were a B2B business delivery business network. But by the time, I don't know, the late noughties, 2008, 2009, when the e-commerce market really started to pick up, and a lot of, say, for example, our mobile phone customers who were mainly distributing mobile phone handsets to shops on the high street and to business users, started to branch into ordering online and deliver to your home. Mm. We could see that happening. We could see growth in that. And we weren't in that space really in a meaningful way. So we decided then that we need to get in on this e-commerce thing, because otherwise we're just going to be left by the side of the road. So it was almost like another sort of new startup, if you like, to open our doors to e-commerce and home delivery and so on. And at that point, we realized that a lot of the home deliveries, in other words, items purchased online and delivered in Ireland, weren't actually originating in Ireland. Most of what's bought in Ireland, I think that's still the case now, 5 years since I left that business, so I'm not so sure. But back then, you know, at least 70% of what's bought online in Ireland doesn't originate in Ireland, doesn't get shipped from Ireland. It gets shipped from overseas, or mostly from the UK. So we, with that in mind, in 2009, we opened a sales office in the UK to address the market there for online shopping deliveries coming to Ireland. And so if you think about it, in 2009, that was just after 2008 when the financial system crashed. We were in the deepest recession that this country had ever seen. Our backs were to the wall, really. And we opened a sales office in the UK. And I think because of the economy and the recession here at the time, it actually, to me, that was a catalyst to drive more people online, because people were shopping for value, right?
So yes, they were
around more. Because the whole online buying, to me, really took off around that time in 2008, 2009. So we opened a sales office in the UK, which was hugely successful. I mean, we signed up one major retailer after another. And between 2009 and 2012, when we started Paris and Hotel, we doubled the turnover of the business. We doubled the turnover of the business that time from probably 25 million a year to 50 million a year between 2009 and 2012.
Wow, during very challenging times. Those years are probably the toughest years in business.
A lot of businesses were in serious difficulty in Ireland then, where we actually doubled our turnover. And we acquired so many big, huge contracts. I mean, the first big retailer to get on board with us in the UK was probably Debenhams, you know, to deliver their online orders to Ireland. And it was a long negotiation because Debenhams were PLC, and, you know, they had a lot of formalities to go through before they could commit to us as a supplier. And we were in there competing with a lot of the multinationals for their business, you know, their delivery business to Ireland. And they were actually only just opening what they call the .ie, their online store in Ireland. So we got Debenhams on board, and that just very quickly grew, ballooned into a huge amount of business. I mean, it went from a trickle of parcels arriving at first to thousands of parcels very quickly. And so people in Ireland were clearly finding good value online and were shopping with these UK retailers. And once we acquired Debenhams as a customer, it was literally the other big name retailers formed a queue outside our door, and we just signed them up. I couldn't say it was like, you know, it was like taking candy off a baby, but it wasn't a difficult, you know, we were in the UK market. We were the specialists in Ireland, including Northern Ireland, because we had an operation there too. We could go to big online retailers in the UK and say, listen, we can see that Irish thing, that whole island there. We'll take care of all of that for you. And, We used to do trade shows in the UK, and we'd come away with a prospect list long enough to keep our guys going, our salespeople over there going for 6 months. It was just extraordinary, you know.
So timing kind of met opportunity and you just were right there ready to fulfill the need through trend spotting, I suppose, a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is that, because I mean, if you think about it, we had to transform our business from being a niche specialist international operator to a domestic delivery business, serving a B2B market, and then a domestic delivery business that was also servicing the B2C market, but also also focused on the UK for growth, you know. So, you know, or Great Britain as such, because we had a presence in Northern Ireland. So, I mean, it's about spotting the trend and going with it as much as you can. And at a number of conferences and trade shows and so on, I would have done some keynotes at the time. And I remember, you know, talking about that whole piece about innovation and having to think about innovating the next stage of your business, because markets never stay the same. Consumer behavior never stays the same. Different generations are coming through with different tastes and different attitudes. So you really need to be thinking about, if your business is successful now, that's great, but you can't sit back on that. You've got to take that time and look out the window and say, okay, what's happening next, you know, and then try and place your business in the way of the change of a change that could affect it going forward, you know.
What is it? Ride the wave. Don't try to create the wave.
I was in the. I was a finalist in the Entrepreneur of the Year in 2012. The year we launched Paris Motel, actually. And one of those years, we went on the Entrepreneur of the Year program. The EY thing is fantastic, and they bring, you know, they do an annual sort of trip overseas to see another market and meet other entrepreneurs and this kind of thing. I think it was either that year or the following year, we went on a trip to New York and we met the World Entrepreneur of the Year. At that time, he was a Turkish guy. He had formed a Greek yogurt business in America that went bananas, and he did so well with it. And he won the World Entrepreneur of the Year, which is a huge achievement.
Yeah, because
World
absolutely.
Entrepreneur of the Year is the entire world. And we were lucky enough, EY brought us to meet him. That brought him to meet us. And, you know, he explained it that he was explaining it that he was making an analogy sort of like ice hockey, you know, and he was talking about the great ice hockey players don't go to where
the puck.
The thing, yeah. Is that a puck, is it?
Yeah, the puck.
Yeah, puck. He said, don't go to where the puck is, go to where the puck is going. Mm. And I thought that summed it up very well. So you're thinking about not where the market is now, because that's what you're servicing now. You have to be thinking about you know, getting your business to where you think the market is going. And sometimes that you can be wrong about that. You might make a mistake, and that's okay. But you have to be thinking about that. Otherwise, if you don't try or innovate or, you know, think about the next move, then your business is just going to stagnate anyway, you know?
Is that what led to Paris Motel?
Yeah, I suppose when we got firmly into the B2B, the B2C, you know, the delivery of items bought online, and most of which were going to people's private residential addresses, which was hugely challenging and not a profitable business. Because if I can go back to where we were on the B2B side of things, the reason that was an easy business, and it was an easy business to do, was we'd be going up to high streets in towns and villages in Ireland, delivering to the retail premises mostly, or around the corner to the industrial estate. And you might have a couple of deliveries to make to people's homes. But when we pulled up outside for example, a convenience store, we might have orders from the tobacco companies, the guys selling greeting cards, the suppliers, the packaging suppliers for the deli, you know, batteries, you think about anything that's sold in a convenience store. And they were all coming out of different companies in, say, mainly based in Dublin, that were distributing to the same estate of stores around Ireland. So when we pulled up outside a convenience store, we might have had parcels in our van from 10 customers for that one store, you know. So you had many to one. And it was, you know, our van drivers all over the country were self-employed, mostly self-employed guys. And our arrangements with them would be that we paid them you know, so much per delivery address, and then a few cents for every parcel that went in there.
Okay.
So we had one delivery cost, but we were getting deliveries from maybe, you know, they could be up to, you know, the driver could be going in the door with a trolley load of parcels that were coming from five or six different customers. It was a very easy business to run, very cash generative. And it was kind of very simple business model. When you're delivering on items delivered on or bought online to people's private residences, the chances are that you're delivering a single item that's quite small. So therefore, the shipper wouldn't have paid a whole lot to the shipper, because in parcel delivery, usually the customer pays by the size or the weight of the parcel. You know, so you're going in with a small little thing in an A4 pack going into somebody's private residence. And then those days, the chances are they weren't at home, so you'd have to go back again. Mm-hmm. So that's two delivery attempts. So it was a very, it was actually, while it was the growth play area of growth and lots of volume, it was very, very low margin, very difficult to make business, make money doing that business. And it's actually quite the same now.
It's an area that blows my mind. I think about this far too much. And I see them driving past my house every day, DPD, and they're running from house to house to house. I'm like,
Those guys are incredible. I mean, I live in Malahide, and I know, the DPD driver that covers my area in Malahide used to work for us in Nightline, so I know him quite well. And I really admire those guys. They're so hardworking. And I mean, you're talking about the guy you see in that DPD van, especially if you live in a city, chances are he's going to get in and out of his van 100 times that day. You know, could be 200 times.
It's phenomenal. It's,
you know, you think about even having to get in and out of your car a couple of hundred times if you just parked in a car park and had to get in there. So I really admire these guys. The drivers we had at Nightline as well, they were all great guys, so hardworking. And the same goes for all of the couriers that work for all these parcel delivery companies. They're the guys that are really, really working their, you know, working hard. And, the problem is that, you're saying that going up and down your road is a DPD guy, but there's also a Fastway guy, there's an Unpost guy, there's a GLS guy, there's DHL, there's FedEx, they're all there. And they're all coming up and down your road. And to me, it's driving a lot of traffic onto residential streets. It's polluting and it's risky because, you know, you could have kids playing on the streets, and the more commercial traffic you have on residential streets, the higher the risk is of accidents and so on. So to me, that's not a sustainable way of running these kind of businesses, and that's what brought us to UPOD. But come back to, you asked me about Paris Motel. I'm sorry about the long-winded way about getting around to answer the question.
Oh, this is what the pod is all about. Tangents are our favorite. They're often where the gold is.
So we were firmly in this line of business of delivering parcels to people's homes, and we could see all the challenges that it presented, and we could see how low margin it was as a business activity. And I was at a trade show in Copenhagen in 2010. And again, I'd say to your listeners that are business people that it's very important to take time out from your business and go to the trade shows or go to networking events, because that's where you'll see ideas and meet other people that have better ideas than you. Or you'll see what's going on in other countries, you know. But I was at this trade show in Copenhagen. It was a parcel trade show, you know. And I met Rafa Bruska, who's now a billionaire. He's a Polish businessman, but and a phenomenal entrepreneur, a man that I really admire very much. And he was there with his Polish company. They had a stand at the trade show the name of the company was InPost. Now, he had developed parcel lockers, you know, as a means of delivering parcels in the Polish market. And he had developed all the technology and the hardware and everything around this. And he was selling at this trade show, he was selling his hardware and his software solution to other providers around the world as a sideline to his main business. So that was my first time seeing parcel lockers. And I thought it was a great idea. I thought this is the solution to consolidation of parcel of home, you know, online shopping, removing commercial vehicles from residential streets, reducing pollution and so on. And I just thought this was just a phenomenal idea. And he was saying, look, we have this brand, I don't know what it was called at the time, I think it was called Easy Pack or something like that at the time, but it reminds me of Easy Singles, the cheese, and it looked a bit cheesy, you know, this color scheme and everything was kind of the same. So I said to him, look, hold that thought. I like these machines. And I said, I just, you know, there's no point in me buying one or two off you. If I'm bringing this to Ireland, I need to buy 100 of them. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they were 35,000 euro each, right? So they were quite expensive.
Wow.
And I said, and plus, I don't like your brand. It's a bit Polish or a bit, you know, it doesn't translate well, you know, without being, with all due respect, you know. So I said, I'll go back to Ireland and let's think about this and I'll see if I can develop a brand around this and be thinking about what we're going to do. So Rachel Kelly, who's the marketing consultant who came on board, and she helped us develop the brand. And Bonfire, an agency in Dublin, Rachel worked with the Bonfire guys, and they came up with this phenomenal brand of Parcel Motel, which was just blew us out of the water at the time. And a lot of people, when I launched Parcel Motel, actually thought it was such a good brand and so amazingly executed. A lot of people thought it was a franchise that I'd bought in America and brought it to Ireland, kind of thing, you know. But it was actually completely homegrown by Irish, you know, an Irish agency and Irish talent, and good luck to the guys. And Rafa Bruska then rang me, he called me if maybe 6 months later, kind of thing, and said, how are you getting on thinking about this? And I said, look, we have a brand. And I showed him on the concept, the brand concept and the artwork and so on. So my problem here is, I said, I need 100 of these things. And there's really no point in 2010 asking the Irish banks to fund this, because I'm not going to try and fund it from cash flow. Because as I said, the Irish banks are still very much closed for business here. So we're not going to, we're not going to be able to borrow this money, you know. So he said, okay, leave it with me. He said, I have a sort of a batch in production at the moment. He said, I can put 100 on for you, kind of thing.
Just like that.
Oh, yeah, no, that was his attitude. I mean, Rafa replies to emails with two words, let's go, or, you know, you, or whatever it is.
Nice, I like that.
So he said he went off anyway, and I sent him over the color schemes and all the rest of it. So he came back to me and said, look, we've made 100 of these things for you. And I said,
at 35 okay. grand a shot, was it?
Yeah, I said, yeah, 35,000 a piece, right? Ooh, and okay. To be honest with you, the machines haven't come down that much in price. Like, they're quite, it's still quite an expensive piece of kit, you know. So I said, okay, but you remember, he said, did you make any progress with, you know, getting some money for this? And I said, no. So I said, so what are we going to do? And he said, okay, leave it with me. And he went off again, and he introduced us to a Polish bank. And a Polish bank lent us the money to buy the machines.
Wow.
The initial 100 machines from him, right? At 18% interest rate.
Ooh, spicy.
It was like sticking them on a credit card. Right? So we took it, and because we had the money, we could get them into the market. We launched the brand. We thought, like, this is going to be phenomenal. So we did. You know, we bought the first 100 machines. We got the funding through Rafa's connections in Poland, and we put out the initial 100 Parcel Motels, it just started to snowball into this huge business all by itself.
Was it hard to get the message out there, though? Was it hard to get people's head around what they were?
Yeah, it was. I mean, back then, there was no parcel lockers in Ireland,
no.
So nobody knew what they were, what the concept was. We had the early Parcel Motel, some of them are still in petrol stations. Rafa had a picture. It was very much an Eastern European image of a woman wearing a pair of dungarees with a parcel in her hand. And he said, I can put this on if you want. And I said, yeah, put it on there. So we put that image on the Parcel Motel, the first ones that came in. So it actually kind of explained what it was, that it was for parcels, you know. And I remember even, I was just getting up one morning, or going around the house early one morning, and one of my van drivers phoned me and said, Ian Dempsey's talking about you on the radio. And I shot on the radio, and I just caught the end of Ian Dempsey saying, anyone know what those Parcel Motel things are in the petrol station? I'm curious about that. Does anyone know what they are? Let us know, and kind of thing. So I phoned in, and I got speaking to Ian Dempsey about it on the radio.
Nice.
And explained what it was. And so we got that little bit of publicity. And when we did the actual brand launch, then we actually used the FM, the breakfast show, to do a prize draw or something like that, just in recognition of Ian, because he's very commercial and very savvy when it comes to things like that. And then we just got the word out, and as we got people using them, and the whole thing about Personal Dial at the launch was, I think we gave sort of first three uses free just to get people to the machines to try them and see how easy it was.
Very smart,
because they're just like an ATM, except it's a parcel that pops out instead of a, you know, bundle of cash or whatever, you know. And then it sort of started to take off on places like Boards, and these techie guys were using it to order items, and they were talking it up, and it was very much a brand that was born online and on social media, and the word just spread from there. We did a little bit of television advertising. We had a cartoon, an animated thing done, that we did a little bit of television advertising, but that was just hoovering up the marketing budget. It was just, you know, it was just insane. Whereas we could get a lot more value for money by using digital marketing and all that kind of stuff, all that really good stuff that was coming around at the time.
And again, timing was perfect. 2012, 2013, 2014 was just when Facebook and all them were starting to take off, and, you know, social media was just starting to bubble.
Absolutely. So it was really a brand that lived online. It was born online and lived online, and lots of different forums, and people just started to talk it up, and then it was referenced, you know, it was word of mouth and this kind of thing. Then it just took off. So we started at Paris Motel in 2012. When I left in 2017, which is 5 years later, 530,000 people in Ireland had a Personal Hotel account. It was more than 10% of the population here. So it was a really successful business, very successful brand, and it still resonates a lot with consumers. And we're hoping to achieve that same thing with Oopod. You know, we're kind of cheekily referred to, you know, Oopod as brought to you by the makers of Personal Hotel. You know, so that,
it's not lying. It's true.
Look, it is. But I mean, at the time, you see, we had the Nightline brand, which was a trusted brand in Ireland at the time. It'd been around for 20 years. And we had that brand association going on with Paris Motels. So it was easier for customers to warm to it and trust it, because it was linked to a known brand. Whereas Oopod is very much standalone and is, you know, it's in its infancy. So we're hoping to achieve that same sort of household name status.
I think if you can tie in, like, the feeling of using Personal Hotel was fun, right? You went over to the screen, you popped in your digits, and then pop, the little magical thing popped open beside you and grabbed your parcel. And there was just a little buzz every single time you used it. So I think if you do the same with this, you're definitely on a winner.
Yeah, no, it's important to have that kind of fun and appeal to consumers. You know, as you say, it's fun to engage and fun to use, and has the whole brand has a nice, really colorful and warm feel to it. So we achieved that very well with Paris Motel, and, you know, we hope we've got it right again this time around, with, you know, just with a newer and fresher kind of brand. You know,
we lived on a barge for 4 years, and Paris Motel was our post box. We would get everything sent there. So in Ringsend, that's the local Parson Motel was literally our daily post box. So it was so useful.
The one in Ringsend at the Maxwell station.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Great location, actually. Yeah.
It's not there cracker. Anymore. Yeah. I'd say it was very popular. Yeah. How did you, that reminds me of a question I was just about to ask you. How did you figure out where to put them, as in like the petrol stations as a route to market?
Well, what we did was, we'd seen the examples. We'd been to Poland and we'd seen the examples of seeing how InPost did it in Poland. And so petrol stations were important to them as pickup points. So we focused on petrol stations and convenience stores as collection points. I remember going to see the CEO of Topaz at the time, which is now Circle K. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry now, but I don't remember his name. I could look it up for you. But he was the CEO of Topaz at the time. And I asked him to give me 10 minutes because I wanted to show him a new concept. And he said, okay. And I said to him, as I was sort of opening my laptop in his office, I said to him, if you don't get this in 10 minutes, you won't get it, you know? And he said, okay, sure. What have you got? So I just had a few slides and pictures of the InPost lockers in Poland at different petrol stations. And I was saying to him, look, this is a big trend in Poland and I think it's going to go well in Ireland. And so he said, no, I'll just stop you there. He said, do you not know my background? He said, this guy was a Donegal man at the time. And he said, you don't know my background? And I said, well, no, apologies, I don't. I just know you're the CEO here. And he said, no, he said, before I was the CEO here, he said I was the CEO of Statoil. Do you remember? They're a big petrol sales network. Yeah, they were in Ireland for a while. Yeah. Topaz bought them, actually. It became Topaz in Ireland. It was a buyout or something like that. But he said, I was the CEO of Statoil in Scandinavia. And he said, in Scandinavia, we have these things at every petrol station.
So oh, wow. Said,
where do I sign? He said, because we'll have one of these at every Statoil. Amazing. If you can do it.
Because they knew it was a dry footfall.
Yeah, no, he knew it was a footfall driver. And he knew, and also he explained to me at the time, it was something I didn't know, that petrol stations tend, the users of petrol stations tend to be men in the mornings, right? So it's mainly males that go to petrol stations and mostly in the morning time. Whereas he said, what parcel lockers do, he said, is it brings females in the afternoon.
So he
said it's a great counter-cyclical footfall driver into petrol stations. And he said, we'll have all you can supply.
Amazing. So you had your synchronicity there and you had your route to market. That is incredible.
Well, look, the man, look, there's a great CEO, right? He didn't beat around the bush. He knew it was something. He didn't try to, lowball me or say, oh, yeah, well, look, we might be interested. Why? And all that. He knew straight away that it was something they wanted. And I think Topaz is Circle K now. Yeah. And I think at the time when I left in 2017, at least 40% of parcel motels were actually located at Topaz at the time. So I'd imagine that's still the case. I don't know anything about parcel motel now because it's so long since I left. But Circle K was prior to that, Topaz was a huge outlet for us, you know. And not every petrol station obviously was suitable for, you know, you had to have a suitable site, a suitable location at the sites for them and all that kind of stuff. But as where they could have them, we did put them in. And yeah, it's a proven footfall driver. And and then we'd find, like, at 500,000 registered users with so many people using them every week, like people like yourself, you're using them purely for convenience. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd have to get you signed up to Oopod now for the same reasons.
Well, tell me all about it. That's what we're here for. So Oopod, what's happening? Where are they going to be? What are they?
So Oopod is very similar to Paris Motel. Only the difference is that when you ordered something to Paris Motel, it went to a receiving center, either in Belfast or in Dublin. And then parcel motel guys, drivers went and put it into the parcel locker for you to come and pick up. Oopod is different from the point of view that it's actually the network of lockers itself is actually open to anybody to use. It's open to all couriers, all consumers, all merchants for click and collect orders and all the rest of it. So it's completely open and agnostic network of parcel lockers. So instead of the parcel coming to a receiving center and then, you know, what would be a UPS guy now bringing it to the parcel motel, it's open for all the couriers to use, to DPD and all these. They can go directly to the parcel locker and put the parcel in there for you. So it's for delivery of your online orders. So again, customers can sign up, go online, sign up, get their UID, which is, you'd be familiar. You had your parcel motel ID in your parcel motel.
Yeah.
So you get your UID, and then that becomes your sort of unique reference and your personal postcode. You'll select your Oopod location where you want your parcel delivered. You put your UID on the in the delivery address, and then when the parcel delivery driver comes along, he just puts in your UID and puts the parcel in the locker. Then you'll get a text or an email to tell you to come and pick it up. And similarly, they'll also be available for customers to drop off returned items. So if they're returning something to a retailer, depending on the relationship the retailer has with the courier, they can drop that off at Oopods as well, and the couriers will pick them up from there. Also, if you have an Oopod outside your store and you're selling online, that can, you can do your bricks and mortar store, you can use it as your click and collect pickup point. But if you're an online seller, you know, if you sell on social media, you have your orders that you want to send out, you can put them directly into the parcel lockers as an online merchant. And so that means you can reduce your courier costs, your packaging costs, and so on. You can put it just in a little bag, because the next person that's going to see that item is your customer. So you don't have to pack them as much in cardboard boxes and bubble wrap and all the rest of it. So it'll withstand a courier journey.
That's a great idea.
Online retailers will be able to put orders in directly there as well. So we think that's a great addressable market. First location that we've opened, actually, because a personal file was very popular for our Belfast receiving address. So you could have a UK virtual address. So people in Ireland could sign on, could have items delivered to our receiving centre in Belfast. And then at the time, we used to bring them over the border, put them into the Paris motels around the country for customers to collect. But that business model is gone now because of Brexit, because of the customs formalities. So if you have something delivered to Belfast and it has to be delivered over the border to a point in Ireland, it means that it has to be declared to customs and so on. So what we've done to sort of help people that are on cold turkey because of the Paris motel UK virtual address, what we've done is we've opened our first UPOD location in Jonesboro in Northern Ireland. So it's just, you actually just go up the M1, Junction 20, there's Jonesboro, and we've got an UPOD location there. So it's actually in Northern Ireland. Rather than in Ireland. So it's a delivery point. It's essentially a UK delivery point, a bit like you had with Paris Motel. Mm-hmm. The only difference this time being that you have to go over the border and pick up the parcel yourself rather than it being shipped, which makes it a different transaction, which requires customs clearance and so on. But if you're going in person to pick up a parcel, it's the same as going to Newry to do your shopping. It's just, you're doing cross-border shopping.
I see what you did there. Smart.
Yeah, and look, we opened this lovely little store in Jonesboro. We've got two great people, local staff working there, Maureen, and another girl has just started this week. And so they're there to help. And so you can actually, if you've ordered something, say like a garment online, you can go to Jonesboro. We've got a fitting room there, so you can actually try it on and see if you want it, if you want to keep it or whatever. Because so much of what gets bought online gets returned. So there's the store there where you can pick up your parcels, drop off parcels, and then they can. There's the fitting room where you can try stuff on.
That's a really smart one. I saw that on social media and I was like, that's really clever. Because very rarely do you see like little innovations.
It just means that you don't have
smart.
Because we know that people might travel to this service, it means that you don't have to bring what they bought home to try it on. And then if they want to return it, have to go back there again.
Yeah,
so it means that there's a fitting room there, they can try it on. If they don't like it or want to return it to the retailer, they can leave it with us and we'll have the courier coming. Because most items you buy in the UK will have a returns label, a free returns label anyway. So they can leave it. They don't want it and they want to return it. They can leave it with us and then we'll arrange for the UK courier or the courier in Northern Ireland to come and pick it up from us and send it back to the retailer.
Brilliant. And where are the other UPODs going to be? Where are the rest of them going to be rolled out?
Oh, look, the next one, the first one in Dublin is already there. It's actually in Parkright in... It's in the Parkright multi-story in the IFSC.
Ah, okay, yeah, I know it.
Not too far from the University of Ireland there, campus there on the IFSC. The next one is either already being installed or certainly this week it's due to be installed at Supervalue in Ranelagh. But we'll have at least, at least 50 of these in Dublin, 50 of these UPOD pick-up and drop-off points around Dublin. Within the next few months, because we have 50 here that we have in our headquarters here in Santry. We have machines good, ready to go. We're just getting them prepared. Takes a little bit of time to agree. When we agree a site, for example, we've agreements made with Parkright, the car park people, Opcoa, the car park people, Euro car parks. So their car parks are good places to have these things, multi-story car parks. So we've agreed, locations with them, but then it takes a little bit of time. We have got to go and survey the site, make sure it's safe for people to use and so on. And then we have to get some wiring in there because the machines need power and so on and so forth. So it takes a little bit of time. We have them. We're ready. We're starting the rollout process. We've agreed a lot of locations. We've a number of the petrol station networks really interested in taking them on. So we're agreeing sites and so on. And again, a number of supermarkets also interested in having them. So we're just in the process now, our team here, agreeing locations and getting the sites prepared, and we'll start rolling them out. So customers will start to see them more and more than now over the next few months. We're probably a full 6 months behind in our rollout because We challenges this equipment is manufactured in China, so we challenges getting containers out of China,
of course,
due to COVID.
Yeah.
And then you might remember around this time last year, I think it was around this time last year, not far off it, the Suez Canal got blocked.
Yes. So your pods were sitting there. They were on that ship.
We were, our pods were like either getting ready to leave they were getting ready to leave the port in Shenzhen Shenzhen port got shut down, I think, for a month at one stage because of COVID. And then when it opened up again, the Suez Canal got blocked. So it was just one challenge after another. And in the meantime, the cost of shipping a container from Shenzhen to Dublin was escalating by the day. But look, we've overcome those challenges now. The equipment is here. It's working really well. The first one that we put into Jonesburg was a kind of a test site as well, where we were just making sure that everything was stable, the software environment. Mm. We have a great software development team on board as well, and have developed some really cool software. Just needed to test that in the wild, because it was all in a test environment. So we just needed to make sure that it's all working okay and that customers can, we can put parcels in and customers can get them out and all the notifications and all that kind of stuff,
your
SMS messages, all that's working. So it's all working fine. So it's, Jonesburg is open for business. We've got a steady stream of customers there coming in every day. It's growing. Growing steadily, now we'll be ready to focus on the Dublin market and get them out there. And I should say that it'll be Dublin only for the time being. We're going to focus just on Dublin, and then we look at the other towns and cities around Ireland after that in terms of our rollout plan,
Perfect. Where can people sign up and learn more?
So oopod.com, oopod.com. They can learn more about the business there, register there, and then we're on all the social media channels as well, including TikTok.
Class. John, thank you so much for taking the time.
I should just say we had they used to be called bloggers not so long ago, but they're called influencers now. We had an influencer feature us there last weekend, and we got a lot of traction from that. A lot of people have shown a lot of interest, so it's really promising.
Brilliant. Class. We'll keep an eye on it. John, thanks for coming on the pod.
You're welcome. Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed my chat with John. I'll be back here on Monday with an Idea Lab. You should jump on to my website, mrgaryfox.com, and join my newsletter, which goes out every single Monday. It's like a little companion to the podcast. So jump on and join that, where I'm giving away some cash prizes in the next couple of weeks as well. I'll see you back here next Monday. Have a great week.